So Eli, I'm going to tell you a secret. If you're outside counsel and you represent my company and I'm the chief IP counsel, you have two jobs. You have two jobs. You either get me promoted or you get me a bigger chief IP counsel job. That's your job. It's plain and simple.
Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP, hosted by Eli Mazur. What is outside counsel's real job? How do you make patents part of a 100-year-old company's DNA? Why did Ocean Tomo fail to become the Goldman Sachs of patents? How do you get opposing counsel to offer you a dream job? The Renaissance man of IP, Raymond Million, shares these secrets on this episode of Clause 8. Ray previously served as chief IP officer at Volvo and is now the CEO of the IP boutique Harness IP. Prior to that, Ray served as the general counsel of a groundbreaking IP business, helped rebuild the IP program of a Fortune 100 company after the Great Recession, and founded the PCT Law Group. On this episode, Eli talks to Ray about how to succeed as in-house counsel and outside counsel, how to properly build a patent portfolio for a major corporation, and what it takes to make it in the IP field. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution.
You're the Renaissance man of patent law. You know, most people join a firm and they stick around their whole career. Maybe they move to another firm, maybe they go in-house, but that's where kind of ends for you. But you've really been everywhere. I think your family's from Haiti. You grew up in Brooklyn.
Yep.
And then you somehow became interested in patents and patent law. Can you tell us about that? Do you remember when you first learned about patents and what was your impression of the role?
Yeah, well, Eli, I like to sort of say, well, thanks for the fabulous introduction, first of all. And it's my honor to be here on your great podcast, your Clause 8 podcast. I've seen some of your previous guests. So, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, I would have been thrown out of places like this.
I'm from Brooklyn myself. So,
yeah, so I'm happy to be here. But I like to say I sort of like Forrest Gump my way into patent law, right? So I guess, coming from an immigrant family, as you mentioned, my family's from Haiti. They emigrated from Haiti, which is and at the time was the sort of the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And, my parents came here not speaking English, landed in New York like a lot of Haitians. If you're Haitian, you either end up in New York, Boston, or Miami. So I'm glad I got to Yankee land and, not been a Red Sox fan. And I don't think the Marlins were a thing back then. So I went to Catholic school for 12 years, did really well in school. And luckily, my high school soccer coach was an alum of Columbia University and asked me in my junior year or late, early senior year where I was going to college. And I was like, I have no idea. And he took me on his own dime and time, Stephen Sullivan, my high school soccer coach, to visit Columbia and said, you're going here. And I said, okay, sure, I'll apply. And so the rest is history. And then when I got to Columbia, my parents are like, well, what are you going to major in, right? And I'm like, I don't know. I probably want to major in English or political science or something like that. They're like, nah, this place is expensive. You need to major in something where you get a job. So I ended up in the engineering school, majored in computer science, and became a programmer. And I got a job at GE, at the time was GE Aerospace. It's now Lockheed Martin after so many mergers. But I was programming 10 hours a day on some military projects. I think I was working on the GPS constellation replacement satellites on the Air Force, writing ground station test software in a basement with no windows, no reception, like a secure, military style facility. And I was doing that 10 hours a day. And I'm like, this can't be it. I like to talk to people. Yeah. And I remember the nuns used to tell me that I should go to law school because I like to argue. And so I'm like, okay. So not having any lawyers in the, in my family, I bought a copy of US News and World Report. And then I started reading about different areas of the law. And I read about patent law where you need an engineering degree and you represent engineers. I'm like, okay, so that's got to be cool. And it was also the highest paying and still is to this day, probably one of the highest paying fields of the law. And then I looked at US News and World Report. GW was ranked number one. And I'm like, I'm going to apply there. And I got in. And then after my second year, I got an internship at Stern Kessler in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
The famed, you know, 40-year-old, now, you know, over 100 IP lawyers, IP boutique. And so it's like Forrest Gump, man. It's like, that's how I ended up here.
Yeah.
And long-winded answer, but I felt that you needed the details.
No, yeah, it's all very interesting. So you went to Stern, you joined Stern, but did you have a dream job in mind at that point? Like, I want to do X.
No, my dream job was one where the checks cleared.
That's always good.
Yeah, it's always good. And I remember, yeah, so it's like I ended up at Stern Kessler, and, you know, nobody in my family knew what a patent lawyer was or whatever. And I just started writing office action responses and then eventually started writing my own patent applications. But fortunately for me, I graduated law school at the height of the dot-com boom.
Yeah.
Right? And we were representing so many startups in the what back then was called the AOL Tech Corridor in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
And not only was I just the patent lawyer for these companies, I became sort of like the general counsel for these companies.
Yeah.
So after 4 years of doing prep and process and starting to do a little bit of agreement work, I moved over to DLA Piper, which was the venture capital firm in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
And I was the IP lawyer working on the corporate with this corporate securities team.
Oh, interesting.
Doing transactional work, and that's where I really found my calling to do IP transactional work. And so, yeah, like I said, I just kind of lucked into it. And then my dream job was really to be a Fortune 500 chief IP counsel.
Yeah.
So, and I achieved that by the time I was 34, and that's why I've been in trouble ever since, trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up.
Yeah. So before we get to that, you were a general counsel at Ocean Tomo, which actually, coincidentally, a previous Clause 8 guest, Professor Steve Yelderman, was a patent analyst at the same time. Obviously, Ocean Tomo was in the news all the time. It was a big thing. Yep. I mean, what was your vision for Ocean Tomo when you joined? And I think, let me know if it's not fair to say, but it's probably that vision didn't kind of play out as they imagined. Why do you think that is?
No, that's a fair statement. It's a very fair statement. So, you know, after Stern Kessler and DLA Piper, I went in-house at American Express, right? And I was like the number two or three patent attorney there. And then within 2 years, I was on the cusp of being promoted to chief IP counsel. And then I happen to be reading the Wall Street Journal, and I see like that Ross Perot invested in this Chicago startup that wants to be the Goldman Sachs of intellectual property.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So I go to their website, and I happen to know the CMO, Wendy Chow, from back in her days when she ran the software patent conference in New York every year. And so I sent her an email saying, congratulations, saw the article in the Wall Street Journal. You guys are doing well. And she's like, oh, you should fly out to Chicago and meet the CEO of Ocean Tomo. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds cool. And so I flew out there, and I never forget this. I was supposed to meet him at like 9 o'clock in the morning or something like that.
Yeah.
So I flew in, got there. They were like, he's busy, but we want you to meet somebody else. I'm like, okay. And then that happened four times. And by the time I finally met with him, like close to noon, he's like, I've already talked to everybody you've met with this morning. You should come join Ocean Tomo and be general counsel. I'm like, who makes a patent guy general counsel and crazy enough to do that? The vision was to really be sort of like, Goldman Sachs essentially has different desks, right? And it's different ways, you know, it's almost like a casino, right? It's different ways for the house to make money, right? It can be equities, it can be FX, right? It can be debt securities, right? It could be derivatives or weather derivatives or whatever the game du jour is, right? And so I saw that same vision for Ocean Tomo, is that we would do different things in terms of IP, transacting IP. And boy, when we did the first ever live patent auction at the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco, and hired the auctioneer from the Antique Roadshow, and we did it sort of like if we were auctioning classic Porsches or, you know, things like that. I mean, it made a lot of news. We became famous. Great. But the reason I think the vision didn't turn out is because unlike art or classic cars, there's not enough inventory to really run a Ritz-Carlton auction every 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, it's no secret, right? You know, most companies' portfolios, you know, people would argue 90% of the patents probably have no value, right? So getting to that 10% or even 5%, some people would argue 3%, getting that 3% to be on the auction block every 6 months is almost impossible, right? Yeah. And so that's why I think the vision didn't pan out. But I think, you know, look, I give a lot of credit to the founders of Ocean Tomo. They tried, yeah. Right? They had the guts to try. And, you know, and that's what startups are all about. You give it a try. You see if there's a market. You see if you can scale. And if you can't, you move on to the next venture.
And then you actually, following that advice, you moved on to start your own PCT Law Group. And I think that's when I first, you know, noticed you. And you became involved in public policy work, kind of lobbying on patent issues. Can you tell me, when did you like start thinking about the roles that public policy debates, what impact they have on patents?
Yeah, sure. Well, so Eli, that again, I kind of Forrest Gump my way into it as well, right? So when I left Ocean Tomo, I moved to DC, back to DC from Chicago, and I started PCT Law Group. And it was just going to be, you know, a law firm that was going to just do corporate law and IP law, right? Yeah. Sort of my experience from DLA, where I see that there's a lot of corporate transactions, but the IP in technology companies really drives the valuation of those companies. But being in DC, you're always surrounded by that public policy aspect. You're always surrounded by that public policy aspect. And then I met Chris Israel, which at the time was still the first ever U.S. IP czar at the Department of Commerce. And I think his term was ending, or he was looking to go back into the private sector. And I'm like, look, we're doing corporate law, we're doing IP law, valuation. You know, we're in DC. Why don't we also start doing public policy?
Yeah.
And that's how that third leg came into PCT Law Group. And, you know, it was all ahead of our time, right? Yeah. Ocean Tomo, those ideas were ahead of its time, right? You know, sort of like running a full scale IP practice with corporate and with lobbying was ahead of its time. And, you know, so that sort of lasted, about 6 years. But at the end of the day, you know, it was a lot of burnout, right? You know, as you know, being a partner at a large firm, as you know, is it's a lot of work. But, you know, doing that and running your own law firm, you know, we had built a law firm from nothing to like 10 people, you know, millions of dollars in billables, but it wasn't personally sustainable. I burnt out, you know, lost a marriage because of it. You know, I'm being totally honest and transparent, right? So, you know, I burnt out. And then I said, okay, what can I do? What did I really love doing? And, you know, I really loved my time being in-house at American Express. And that's when I went back to in-house, and I ended up back at GE, where I started my career as an engineer and was a graduate of the Edison Engineering Program, which is their management training program. And I ended up back in Chicago, which is ironic, at GE Healthcare, being head of software IP for GE Healthcare.
You said you were ahead of your time in terms of lobbying in the space of patent policy. Even now, it's probably arguably not as developed as lobbyists on taxes and all of that.
Sure. I
mean, what did you learn about doing that type of work? Is it hard to convince Company X, you know, spend money on giving you public policy advice? Is it, you know, is that practice much harder than it is, let's say, patent prosecution or even litigation? Or
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, like, you know, sort of patent prosecution is very transactional, right? It's like file a patent application and, you know, you charge, you know, 10,000, 5,000, 7,000, whatever, you know, based on the complexity of the case. But, you know, being on a monthly retainer, like the way the lobbying world works, and doing that from a small firm, right, you know, not being sort of like, you know, a Patent Boggs or Squire Patents, whatever it's referred to these days.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Akin Gump, you know, not being sort of like, you know, one of the white shoe firms or, you know, Magic Circle firm or whatever, you know, exclusive club you want to mention in whatever relevant jurisdiction. So it was tough to do it from a small firm on that scale, right, with those important issues. And I think, you know, nowadays there are a few shops that, you know, that specialize in IP issues, but they're on a much larger scale and have much more financial backing. Right. And back then, you know, it wasn't really sort of it's not where you can get sort of venture capital money to back a law firm, right? It's like, maybe in Arizona you could do that today, but that's a relative. And in Australia you can do that, but it's a very recent development.
You mentioned you went back to American Express, but I think you actually helped to restart Goldman Sachs' IP program as well.
Yeah, so my last year at BCT Law Group, I got a call from a former American Express colleague who was outside counsel to Goldman Sachs. And in the financial crisis, 2008-2009 timeframe, Goldman Sachs had shed a lot of its, overhead functions, right? They kept the traders, right? The money makers, right? So everything was really outsourced at Goldman Sachs, and they were looking to sort of revamp their IP program. So I spent 6 months there full-time, just looking at what IP they had, looking at their processes, looking at their portfolio, looking at their providers, sort of helping them to start to take that back in-house, whereas they had outsourced everything at Goldman Sachs. I mean, everything. Yeah, HR was outsourced.
Okay. No, because I was going to ask, looking at that, it's kind of crazy. I mean, obviously it was a difficult time for everybody, but, Goldman Sachs, they weren't bankrupt or anything like that. What does it say about the IP system that a company, when it has to make those kind of decisions, says, we actually can get rid of it altogether, not worry about it for 5 years? I mean, what are the lessons from that?
Well, if it wasn't Goldman Sachs, I think the lesson would be a greater lesson, right? Yeah. I mean, a place like Goldman Sachs that, has, doesn't make a product, has, doesn't have a supply chain, doesn't rely on like engineering talent, right? It's a financial house, right? Yeah. So for them, they could easily shed that. But a lot of technology companies did the same thing as well, right? Shame on them. Right, where their profits, their profit margin really depended on bringing new products to the market. So for Goldman Sachs to do it, they're not the poster child for why corporate America didn't think IP was important.
Right.
But it certainly gives you an indication of how people thought that we didn't really need that that function. But at some point they got the IP religion again and decided to that they needed to bring the build a department and bring it back in house and actually have some full-time IP folks, for sure.
Yeah. You were there also at a kind of an interesting time. It was after Bilski, right before Alice. And obviously that has a big impact in terms of the type of patents that you can get and that are enforceable. I mean, putting them aside, but in general, you've written a lot about software patents, obviously.
Yeah.
How should a financial services company think about building a patent portfolio? Do you have any thoughts about that? Is it, like you said, it's not a company that makes products.
Yeah. I mean, look, the software patent debate has been going on for, decades now, right? Most of my career, right? I started my career like right around right after In re Beauregard, the famous IBM case where, there's a computer program product claims, the special means plus function claims to claim software on a medium as opposed to method claims where the software is running. Which obviously helps for injunction purposes pre-eBay and not having to wait to sue the customer, but the person who provides the product. So software patents has permeated my entire career. But a financial services firm, I think these days, if they're bringing new products to market, and the products are not something like maybe you could hold on to this, but it's a new financial product, a new financial offering, I think. Even with Bilski, even with the state of Alice, even with the state of software patents to these days, I think they ignore patents at their peril, right? Because I know, look, the Wall Street banks have always been a target of non-practicing entities, right? And, whether some of those patents that are being asserted against them get knocked out on 101 under Alice or Bilski or whatever the case may be, they're still being hit a lot, and I think they ignore patents at their peril. So from at least a defensive standpoint, I think they have to address patents from a clearance standpoint. And then once they're tired of being on the wrong side of the V, then they have to start saying, okay, can we ourselves get some patents on the products that we're offering?
Yeah.
And hire the right attorneys to figure out how not to claim those as sort of like business methods, but also how to claim those as part of a system. Right. Yeah. Even at Amex, right? We didn't only have business method patents, right? We had some patents on, on chemistry, right? You know, like clear cards, right? How to get a clear card to be recognized by an ATM machine. So, I mean, there's a lot of opportunities there. And so financial services companies write a lot of code, right? They're probably one of the biggest producers of code other than the software industry itself.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of opportunities there to file patents and not to ignore them, because I think they do that. They do so at their peril.
And we'll definitely talk more about patent development, because I think that's a topic you and I are both passionate about. But I want to talk about your time at Volvo. Obviously, you became a chief IP officer. For somebody who hasn't been in the role, can you tell, like, what does it involve? What did you see your role as being when you were there?
Sure. So, you know, when I got there, my title was chief IP counsel. And then by the time I left, it was chief IP officer. And that's because I took on, I also was the CEO of Volvo Car Ventures. And so they just gave me a chief IP officer title. So, you know, title aside, let's just talk about chief IP counsel. You know, I guess there's a lot of misconception about what a chief IP counsel does, right? And if you're a chief IP counsel of a startup or a medium-sized enterprise where you're also the only IP counsel, there's a lot of rolling up your sleeves and there's a lot of what you would call traditional work, right? You're going to take some invention disclosures. You're going to have brainstorming sessions. You're going to file trademark applications on the branding for new products and services. You're going to review the IP clauses of a lot of vendor agreements. You're going to do a lot of that traditional work. But if you get to a certain size of a company, you know, $1 billion company, $20 billion company, $30 billion company, $100 billion company, then, you know, the chief IP counsel role, I hate to tell you, really becomes 50% HR, right? You know, so because I had 20 people reporting to me, right? My previous job, I had 17. My job before that, I had 5. And people reporting to you is not something that you take lightly. It's not something that you learned in law school, or, you know, at least not when I went to law school. I'm not sure if they're, if you have a JD MBA, maybe you take a management class, but most likely you don't. And so there's a lot of HR, right? Because you're going to have people that are going to specialize. You're going to have trademark paralegals. You're going to have legal assistants. You're going to have patent attorneys. You're going to have transactional attorneys. And how do you, you know, at a company the size of Volvo, a $24 billion company, right, that has, you know, a couple of thousand dealerships in 100-and-something countries, right? Like, I cannot do all that myself, right? And so it's a matter of trusting the people that work for you. And how do you trust the people that work for you, right? You have to recruit them. You have to manage them. You have to retain them. You have to make sure that they get developed. And you have to make sure they're happy. And so 50% of the job is managing people and what I call HR. And that's what people don't realize. When you're chief IP counsel, that title comes with a lot of responsibility to get the best out of your people every day. Because I cannot read every patent application. I cannot file in, every trademark application. And I can't review every IP clause in every vendor agreement. Your team has to do that. And so, again, 50% of the job is really HR and managing people.
Obviously, when you took that job, you moved to a different continent. You moved to Sweden. Mm-hmm. You came into a company that's obviously famously innovative. They famously got the patent for the seat belt. It was already part of their DNA, the innovation and the patent process somewhat, or at least historically in that sense. What advice would you give to somebody else coming into that role of a big company like that and trying to decide, all right, I'm here. What do I do now, kind of?
Well, so the premise of your question, I have to challenge a little bit, right? So Volvo is a 96-year-old Swedish company, right? Yeah. And you know, it had gone through a period where it was owned by Ford for about a decade. And then when I got there, it was had been another decade where it was owned by the Chinese, but the Chinese were really hands-off.
Yep.
Right? So Volvo, as if you look at Volvo, from, where 90% of the R&D takes place in Sweden, they were famously an innovative company, but not a famously patent-type company.
Okay.
Right? Because the culture in Scandinavia, there's something in the Scandinavian culture called Jantelagen, right? Which means that, you know, no one person is that special.
Okay.
Right? It's more about the collective than it is about the individual.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're a Star Trek fan, it's like, sort of like being part of the Borg, right? The collective, right? So the way that lends itself is that engineers at Volvo or a lot of Scandinavian countries don't typically raise their hand and say, look, this is a cool thing that I invented. Right? They just think that, hey, I'm just doing my job. So they were famously innovative, but didn't have a really big portfolio and had gone through a decade where the IP portfolio was really managed out of Detroit through Ford. So when I got there, I came into an innovative culture, but not a culture that recognized IP rights.
Yeah.
So it was really a startup job. It was really a startup job. And people, and another part of being chief IP counsel is the first thing you do when you get to any company is you learn the culture. You yeah. learn the culture there, right? You learn, you take time, you learn the culture, you talk to all the stakeholders, you see what's being done, you do a competitive landscape of where you are compared to your peers. So I can easily see where I am next to Volkswagen, next to BMW, next to Daimler, next to Ford, GM, Toyota, Tesla, so on and so forth. So I learn the culture, I do a competitive landscape, and I say, if I am going to survive at this job in this company where my pension, 401k, stock options, bonus, salary all depend on it, what do I need to do to contribute to the bottom line, right? Because if I really believe the hype that IP is 75 to 80% of the value of any operating concern, then as a chief IP counsel, I'm really chief revenue officer. The value of the company is really based around the IP, right? So if I really believe that, then what do I need to do as chief IP officer to facilitate the value of that IP to make it more valuable? And when I say 50% of the job is HR, another 25% of the job is marketing, right? Because gone are the days where if you happen to work at GE or IBM, as chief IP counsel, you don't have to do much marketing. People find you. Right? The culture is such that the inventors are filling out invention disclosure forms, and you have the luxury of rejecting 75% of them and filing on the 25%. But if you're in a company where there's no corporate culture or corporate DNA of actually filing for patent rights, right? How do you sit there and just, you know, wait for the phone to ring and wait for invention disclosure? It's not going to happen. You have to go out there and market. So 50% is HR, 25% is marketing. Right. So first thing I did is I held town halls and I showed, nothing works really well than a newspaper clipping saying some company lost a patent lawsuit and had to pay billions. Right. Or some company didn't protect their IP. It walked out the door and their competitor got it. Right. And so town halls, brainstorming sessions, I assigned the IP counsel to each department within R&D. And I told them, it's like you're a salesperson. Right. If you're at your desk, you're not doing your job. If you're a salesperson and you're at your desk, you're not doing your job, right? You should be going out, meeting clients, playing golf with prospective customers. Same thing as the IP counsel. You should be embedded in the R&D teams and seeing how they work to be able to get invention disclosures. So to me, that's the marketing part where you have to go out and market to get invention disclosures where you can start now, instead of filing at 100% invention disclosures, 75%. 50%. And the lower that number gets, the more invention disclosure you're getting and the better the quality of your IP portfolio.
Yeah. Did you get any pushback? I know some in US engineering companies, where a lot of engineers, they hear about patent trolls and stuff like that. And some are just naturally hostile to the idea of patent rights.
Absolutely. I got a lot of pushback, right? I mean, I felt like a bull in a china shop, right? And then that's when I think... So in the beginning, I think I made a lot of mistakes, right? I assumed there was sort of like not only like a US style culture, but more of a New York style culture where you're like push, 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 push. And you realize you're in a culture where that's considered rude, right? Or obnoxious even, right? So I had to take a step back and figure out how to do my marketing and how to maybe make the message, right? And sometimes the message is, oh, we have to make more money. So that message may not resonate, especially in a Scandinavian culture, right? So the message really became us, how do we survive as a company? Because we're the largest employer in Sweden. And how do we make sure that your grandchildren can work here just like your grandfather did?
Yeah. Wow. That's
right. So it's messaging. So, yeah. You know, being chief IP counsel is part being chief marketing officer. It's part of being chief HR officer. And then the other 25% is really being a good IP lawyer. So I think that's the part of the job people don't appreciate, really.
Yeah. And you talked about how you told your IP counsel to really become embedded with the R&D teams, become sale. Did you set kind of goals for them in terms of like, this is the number of patents?
I did not. I know a lot of chief IP counsel set goals.
Yeah.
Right. And say this year we're going to file 1,000 patent applications right. or 500 yeah. or 50, whatever the right number is based on the previous year. To me, I think that's the tail wagging the dog. Right. If I'm as chief IP counsel, say next year, Volvo Cars or American Express or Goldman Sachs or GE or whatever company I work for, we're going to file 100 patent applications next year. Right. I'm not in charge of R&D. I have no product, no idea what the product roadmap is. Right. What the marketing strategy is. Right. Like I'm not driving the company. right? So if I say I'm going to file 50 patent applications, what's going to happen, right? If you set a target, you're going to meet it, yeah. Right? And they say, like, look, you never want to buy a car that was built on a Friday, right? Do you want to really enforce a patent that was filed in December?
Yeah.
Right? Because December rolls around.
That's an interesting study to actually make.
December rolls around. 20 patent applications are filed, right? Okay, we got to file 10 more by December 31st, right? Come on, guys. We know that game, right? I don't play that game, right? Yeah. I say this year, I'm going to meet with R&D. We're going to figure out the product roadmap. I'm going to have my folks embedded in there. And we're going to file as many patent applications as warranted.
Yeah.
Right. And the soft target might be 100 because last year we filed 75.
Yeah.
Right. It may be. But again, I don't like to set hard targets because, you know, again, what happens if you're not going to meet that in December? You're going to file on crap.
Yeah.
What happens if you met it by November? You're going to slow down and file them in January.
I mean, one of the reasons this kind of game happens within large companies is because of the budgetary issues, right? They have a certain budget, and if they don't use it, they lose it. Or, I mean, how did you explain within the company both, we need to be spending all this money to build our patent portfolio, and I'm not talking to the engineers, I'm talking to the business folks.
Sure.
And I'm sure that when they hired you, they had that in mind, but, you know, things come up and they change, and they're like, So
I had a budget, right? And part of that budget is like a overhead budget, right?
Yeah.
How many people do I have, salary, so on and so forth, right? You know, the business dinners, the travel, right? So we have that.
Yeah.
Then you have a filing budget, right? And the thing is, other than litigation, your IP budget is usually the biggest part of your legal budget.
Yeah.
Right? And fortunate enough, what I did was I went to the C-suite and I said, look, here's where our patent portfolio is compared to our competitors, right? And in the automotive industry, it's undergoing a transformation, right? We're going to electric vehicles. You know, everyone's talking about autonomous vehicles. You know, the car right now is really, you know, some people would say it's a smartphone on wheels,
yeah.
Right? It's really about connectivity, so on and so forth. And the conversation I had is, look, we filed this many patent applications, which is X or Y percent above or below our nearest competitor, whatever the right comparison is. And I said, look, I'm going to go out, talk to the R&D folks. I'm going to figure out their product roadmap. Oh, this year we happen to be, you know, refreshing our entire product line, right?
Yeah.
So that's going to be a heavy spend year, right?
Yeah.
And the following two or three years, we're not going to refresh our product line, but we might make some, you know, slight upgrades to our product line,
yeah.
Right? So what kind of year are we in? So I have the business justifications, and my rhythm as a chief IP counsel has to follow the chief CTO, right? I have to follow the rhythm of the CTO and the CMO. Right? They're doing heavy R&D, they're putting out new product. So my IP strategy has to be aligned with that. A lot of people talk about, oh, your IP strategy is aligned with your business strategy, right? The most people, that's bullshit, right? They don't even know what that means, right? So how do you know what it means when you're saying, you know, you're sitting in the legal department saying, I'm going to file 100 patent applications and you haven't talked to anybody?
Yeah.
Right? And I was in a fortunate position that where I said, look, here's what's happening in automotive. The automotive patent wars are coming. And here's three stories from the New York Times, Automotive News, and the Financial Times that say I'm right.
Yeah.
Right? Here's the litigation trend. Here's where we're going to put out four new models this year. Right? And you're telling me this is my patent budget, but this is what I need. Right? And I had the fortune of the CEO telling me, I don't care if you blow through your patent budget, we'll give you more.
Okay.
Right? Because yeah. Now you're producing a business case of why you need to file X number of patent applications.
Yeah.
Right? And because my rhythm is with the CTO, with the CMO, aligned with what my competitors are doing and what's happening in the marketplace.
Yeah.
Right? And so, again, I think I just made the business case that here's what I need. And by the way, I'm not even going to spend – I'm going to file more patent applications. But you know what? I may do it with less money because I'm not going to file each patent application in 50 jurisdictions where I have no competitors.
Right. Yeah.
Right? So – one of the first decisions I made at Volvo, for example, was I said, we're not going to file in Sweden anymore. It happens to be a very expensive patent office. And you know what? Wow. Saab no longer makes cars.
Yeah.
Right? So who am I going to sue in Sweden?
Right. Yeah.
Right? So now all that money I was taking filing those patent applications in Sweden, I could file more patent applications and not even spend more money.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not about...
That's a gutsy message to explain.
It's a gutsy call, right? I was waiting for that ticket home and it wouldn't have been first class. that 15-hour flight would have been a coach, but it didn't come. So it made financial sense.
Yeah.
It made financial sense.
Yeah. You were saying it was kind of a startup in terms of building the culture of getting these patent applications filed in the right places and growing the portfolio. How did you think about, like you said, I think you said that 90% of the patents out there are crap. How did you, while you were building the startup, you know, getting these applications filed, also kind of say, make sure that it's a quality patent portfolio and that you're controlling costs at the same time? Like, how did you balance all that?
Yeah, so here's an insider tip that I know a lot of chief IP counsel know that, you know, maybe folks on the outside of a corporation that's not dealing with a P&L may not know. It's, you know, I think when you're in a startup situation, I think you always worry about quantity. And then once quantity gets to be at a certain threshold, right, that certain threshold based on your revenue, based on your industry, based on the technology, then you start worrying about quality.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. If you're getting 5 invention disclosures, your acceptance rate may be 100%.
Right.
When you get 50 invention disclosures, your acceptance rate may be 75%. When you get 100 invention disclosures, your acceptance rate may be 50%.
Yeah.
But if you start getting 1,000 invention disclosures, maybe your acceptance rate is now at 15, 20%.
Right.
Right? So I think, you know, it's a lot of variables, but I think if I'm going to simplify the equation, is that your acceptance rate is higher the lower amount of invention disclosures you receive as a company.
Right.
Right? And then once not innovation is built into the DNA of the company, but once patenting is built into the DNA of the company, obtaining IP rights, then you can start being a little bit more selective in worrying about the quality of the portfolio. But to get quality, you first need quantity.
Okay.
And that's the first thing you tackle.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess, you know, so
it might not be a popular answer, but it's the truth.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
But that's the first part of a process, getting those ID disclosures, right? I guess, mm-hmm. What about the rest of the process in terms of making sure, I don't know, I'm guessing you relied on outside firms, making sure they're actually getting you the patents, you know, that actually cover products that are well drafted, that are enforceable and stuff like that, that kind of are based on the disclosures, they're doing the best job possible? Or is that something kind of, if you have that quantity, you're going to have a portfolio that kind of has...
No. Eli, I think you're right in the first instance. So, you know, you raise a good point. So, you know, not only are you looking at the internal procedures, right? Are we having brainstorming sessions? Are we having patent review committees in each different areas of the business? Are we having a patent review committee in each geography where there's an R&D center? Right? Do we have the right people on the patent review committees? So you're looking at the internal procedures, but obviously, yeah, if you're, you know, unless you're, you know, sort of like a Fortune 50 where you have a large IP staff, or maybe you're a biopharma company where you're doing your prep and process in-house, right? I'm definitely looking at my providers, and I'm looking at the quality, and I'm doing spot checking,
yeah.
Right? And I'm looking at that. And you know, so look, I wasn't always a popular guy. I mean, I think a lot of incumbent law firms, you know, are no longer doing work for, you know, for the companies where I was chief IP counsel, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, I'm going to have to, I cannot review every patent application, right? And I cannot, you know, I can't review even claim one of every patent application because I'm doing 20 other things.
Yeah.
Right? You know, chief IP counsel, one of my biggest concerns is, believe it or not, physical security. Right? Somebody comes into the front gate with a thumb drive, goes up to the right computer, downloads some files and steals IP, right? That's on me.
Yeah.
Right? So so there's a lot of, you know, working with data loss prevention, working with physical security, right? There's a lot of other parts of the job that is not reviewing patent applications, yeah, right? But, you know, it's chief IP counsel. It's not chief patent counsel.
Right.
Right. Sometimes companies have both.
Yeah.
Right. And so, I have to get law firms in there where I trust the quality and I can sleep at night. Right. There are a lot of things that could keep me up at night. And it can't be that, am I getting, you know, am I getting claims that are like, you know, 800 words, you know, 3 pages that no one will ever infringe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Unless it's some kind of standard. Right.
Yeah.
That's, you know, so you're absolutely right. The looking at the quality, running RFPs for outside counsel is a difficult part of the job, because you get a lot of phone calls from a lot of people that, you know, that say, hey, you know, like, you know, send me some cases, right? You're filing, you know, 300 cases, just send me 50 cases, send me 25 cases,
yeah.
Right? But you can't please all the people all the time. And, you know, the more vendors you use, the more things that could go wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I was actually going to ask you, I'm sure when you became chief IP counsel, you know, you probably knew a lot of people. And you were also on the other side trying to get work in your career and maybe now even in your role. What were some of the effective ways that outside counsel got your attention? And what wasn't effective? Any lessons from that?
Sure. So, Eli, I would say, look, I think it's an excellent question. And I think, you know, most chief IP counsel or, you know, chief whatever counsel, you get a lot of emails. You know, yeah. They'll come text messages. They'll come emails. They'll come letters in the mail. They'll come visitors at the doorstep. They'll come messages via LinkedIn. It happens, right? Yeah. Like, you know, everyone is in sales mode and you can't fault them for that, right? Especially having been, you know, in private practice. So I get that. But at the end of the day, what I did was, look, I ran an RFP, right? I ran an RFP and I said, I'm going to make it fair, right? And, you know, so propose to me your rate card, you know, tell me who your proposed team is, and, you know, give me five sample patents in this technology space that you drafted in the past that you think are good cases. Right. And then I have my team go through it, interview the folks, because it's not always about writing a good case. Right. There's a lot of people who can write a good case, but it's also the personalities to deal with the internal clients. Right. I have to know, Eli, if I hire you, right, you're not going to make me look bad in front of the engineers at my company. Right. Because you're my representative, because I chose you. The inventors didn't. Right. So it's about price, quality, personality, fit, you know, trustworthiness. So I think I ran an RFP, selected two or three firms, and just went with those two or three firms.
Is that the most important thing that you think about in terms of how will they represent me as outside counsel to the internal engineers and all that?
So Eli, I'm going to tell you a secret. If you're outside counsel and you represent my company and I'm the chief IP counsel, you have two jobs. You have two jobs. You either get me promoted or you get me a bigger chief IP counsel job. That's your job. It's plain and simple.
All right. That's good advice.
That's your job. If you represent me, you either get me promoted, get me a bigger bonus, or you get me a bigger chief IP counsel job. Just think of it that way and the rest will follow.
That's very good advice. As we talked a lot about Evolva, but I'm sure you had to deal with some litigation and licensors. Did your view of the patent system kind of change in terms of being in an operating company like that? Because people complain about, as we discussed, about patent trolls or anything like that. What was your impression of how the patent system worked?
You know what? Look. I know a lot of my fellow chief IP counsel that say, oh, we hate patent trolls. We hate this. We hate that. The system is da-da-da-da. And then you talk to solo inventors and they say, we hate the big corporations. We hate efficient infringement. We hate Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
But look, for my career, I credit Rob Stern from Stern Kessler. When I was a first year associate, I remember him taking me on a client pitch. And he said to me, Ray, I'm going to teach you to be a Renaissance IP lawyer. And I've always thought about that. And you actually mentioned that as a joke, but it's true. He said, I'm going to teach you to be a Renaissance IP lawyer.
You lived up to his advice.
I took it seriously, right? Look, in this business, you know, I don't care how much of a self-made or hard worker you are, you always need help.
Yeah.
And I've gotten a lot of help along the way, for sure. And my first 4 years and my summers at Stern Kessler were invaluable. But his thing about being a Renaissance IP lawyer was being able to see the IP game from all sides. So I've worked at Ocean Tomo. I've worked as a consultant. I've worked as an IP lawyer. I've worked as an IP lobbyist. I've worked in-house. So I can appreciate everyone is part of the ecosystem. And everyone who's at a white shoe law firm in their ivory tower saying they hate patent trolls, well, if it wasn't for those patent trolls, you wouldn't be able to make the mortgage next month. Right, because because you'd have nothing to defend. Right, so let's all recognize that we can't put people in these broad categories and broad strokes. Right, if you're a solo inventor that pitched your product to a company, the company stole the idea, you went out and got some financing, and hired a contingency firm to represent your interests. And if that is those facts are 100% true, how could someone call you a patent troll? Right? So let's appreciate every aspect of the game and let's make sure the system works for every angle. And it's my thing. So I'm never one to take one camp or the other because, you know, your client may be a patent troll today. It may be an operating company tomorrow, right? And all of them are necessary in the ecosystem.
When you were at Volvo, did you think that the patent system was working for a company like Volvo?
For the most part. I mean, there were instances where I thought it wasn't working. But in the grand scheme of things, I think it worked. You know, we filed our cases. We got our cases allowed. You know, we were on the plaintiff side of the V on patent infringement. Like, you know, I was like, I filed a patent lawsuit in Sweden, right? It's like, who does that, right? Right? Yeah, the New Yorker does that. Yeah, I get it. You know, but we were on the other side of some cases in the Eastern District of Texas, right? So on average, I think the system works well. What I would like to see going forward, if I had a wish, is that the system works faster.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? And could there be some more alternate means to you know, could there be like a JAMS or some kind of alternate dispute resolution strictly for patent cases where everyone respected it, they were top-notch people, and we could get the resolution faster?
Right. Yeah.
Right? And I think that would help the liquidity of IP assets and eventually the valuation. Yeah. You know, like I'm no economist, but that's just my gut feeling.
You know, I was actually reading about how you became a CEO at Harness IP.
Yes.
And the way you met their leader at the time, Bill Coughlin, I believe, mm-hmm. while he was representing Ford and you were representing Volvo. And I guess you guys were in some kind of dispute or licensing negotiation.
Correct.
And out of that, you formed such a positive relationship that he wanted you to come to Harness Dickey at the time. How does that happen? How do you get somebody to like you so much when you're on opposite sides? And, you know, you're...
You know, again, it's like I'm Forrest Gump my way through my entire career, right? Like, who does that happen to? You're exactly right, Eli. We were on opposite sides of the negotiation. We're negotiating a very large license, as you can imagine. And, but I think... I remember what Bill told me was that he appreciated the way I negotiated, my candor. I was always up front, a very New York blunt style. And I had the right temperament. I never lost my cool and whatever. And then, you know, maybe he was happy that at the end of the day, you know, we closed the license and the money went that way. So, yeah. So I have no problems admitting I was a licensee in that negotiation. Yeah.
I'm sure it was a win-win for everybody.
It was a win-win. Definitely was a win-win, for sure.
What made you take that role at Harness IP? It seems like you were really transforming a company, maybe in some ways a country, with that litigation you filed in Sweden.
Yeah, so, there you go. Yeah, that case had a novel issue, and I think it had to go to their Supreme Court.
Wow.
Yeah, because the issue of whether ancillary breach of contract could be filed in the same court as their federal circuit, basically, was novel. It had never been decided in Sweden. Yeah. So I thought that was pretty cool. And the answer was yes. Again, after sort of almost 4 years in Sweden, being away from family and, desiring to come back to the States, being closer to family, Bill came calling at the right time. And, you know, and the opportunity to take the helm of a 100-year-old, now 101-year-old law firm with almost 300 employees and almost 100 lawyers, in a four-office IP boutique. I mean, you know, it was like history in the making. So yeah. that was not lost on me as well.
You mentioned that the job of outside counsel is to get either get the in-house counsel promoted or get you a bigger job.
Yes. And
now, I guess, how do you see doing that now that you're back on the as outside counsel? How do you see attorneys at your firm being able to do that?
So what I tell the attorneys at Harness, when I get on my soapbox and they listen to me, right? So, you know, you know how a law firm is, right? Sometimes yeah. It can be like herding cats, right? That's not unique to any one particular law firm. It's just the industry when you have partners. Yeah. It's different than a corporation, right? Than a partnership than a corporation. But what I tell them is, I tell them those two things. You know, your job is to make the chief IP counsel or the general counsel, if it's a smaller company that doesn't have a chief IP counsel, your job is to get them promoted or get them a bigger job. And the way you do that is that you always have to bring value. And here's what I explain. When you're outside counsel, your job is more like a firefighter, right? You get called because there's a fire. You rush to the client, you put the fire out, and you turn your back and you go back to the station.
Yeah.
But unlike a firefighter, you send an invoice, right? It's not tax money, right? You send an invoice,
yeah.
Right? And I tell the lawyers all the time that your touch with the client cannot be when you first sign the engagement letter and when you send the invoice, right?
Yeah.
So at the every interaction with the client has to be making that client's job easier, right? And the message I deliver, and if you don't mind my German, I'm going to say in a very Brooklyn way.
Yeah.
I'm saying if you don't know more than they know, then you're wasting their fucking time.
Right.
Right? Like, why do I pick up the phone to call outside counsel? Is it because I'm not a good lawyer? Or is it because I don't have the time to read every Federal Circuit case? I don't have time to know the current USPTO or JPO or KIPO or SIPO procedures. Right? So if you're in private practice as outside counsel, and you're not an expert in what you do, you're wasting my time and my money. And that's the mechanics of getting me promoted or getting me a bigger job. Because when I call you, I'm relying on you, right? So Eli, if you don't know, if I call you to prosecute a software patent case for me, right? If you don't know more cases that have been decided under Alice than me, you're wasting my fucking time.
That's quite a challenge with you, you know.
Yeah, it's that simple, right? Yeah. I'm calling on you for your expertise.
Yeah,
right. And as outside counsel, you have to develop a niche. You have to develop an expertise, and you have to understand that when they call you and you're charging $200, $300, $400, $500, $1,000, $2,000 an hour, right? There has to be value for that billable hour.
You know, it's kind of been a full circle for you to come to this role. You started your own firm and you've been in-house at various roles. Has anything surprised you about being back in private practice from now having this vantage point again where the industry has kind of been over the last number of years?
I wouldn't say something has surprised me. I would say that I've forgotten what it is to be a firefighter because I've been a fire warden for so long.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? Because when you're in-house, you're more of a fire warden, right? Because you're not being called to put out a fire and you turn your back, right? You're living in that building. You're looking at the building and you're trying to prevent fires.
Yeah.
Right? And even when you're giving legal advice, you have to live with that legal advice because you don't get to walk back to your office and send an invoice and you're done, right? You see your clients in the cafeteria.
Yeah.
Right? You see your clients in a corporate gym. You see your clients on campus.
Right?
So you're living with your clients, right? So I wouldn't say, Eli, that it's been a surprise. It's saying that it's different to go back into sort of firefighter mode than when you're being a fire warden for so long.
Right.
And that's what's been the adjustment for these last 7 months.
I think you've been active in the patent policy debates. I've seen you speak at conferences. You've been more outspoken than a lot of people in private practice kind of tend to be. What do you think is an effective way to impact where the patent system is? What do you think has been working? What hasn't been working? And I guess, what advice would you give?
Well, quite frankly, I think what's been working on one side of the coin has been actually spending a lot of lobbying dollars, right? And the Senate Judiciary Committee and the like. So I think that's been pretty effective for some people who like to keep the status quo.
Yeah.
What I think has not been effective, I don't know. Like, for example, let's talk about this software patent debate, right? And,
yeah.
You know, previously Director Inokyu has said that, you know, this has sort of been a plague in the profession for over a decade. And what I think has not happened is people are going individually case by case in front of the Federal Circuit trying to get some clarity or trying to get a patent case up to the Supreme Court trying to get some clarity, right? But I don't know if the patent bar has spoken collectively about, hey, we just need to know one way or another of like, you need some predictability.
Right.
Right. When, you know, I'm not sure even what the latest statistics are because, you know, I've been spending a lot of my time on administrative stuff, running a law firm. But, you know, when more than 50% of patents are overturned at PTAB, or more than 50% of the cases are overturned in the Federal Circuit from the U.S. District Courts, that is not certainty.
Yeah.
That is not certainty. And that is not lending itself to a liquid asset class. And so, you know, again, I don't know what the answer is, but I know what the solution, or I don't know how to get to the answer, but the answer has to be, there has to be a collective voice on let's settle these issues and make this space more predictable.
I think it's interesting because in the when they had the proposed Section 101 legislation, even the big attorney, patent attorney groups couldn't even get on, come together on one proposal. Yeah. So I think, is that what you're kind of talking about? The kind of be willing to come to some kind of agreement within the patent bar
Yeah, we need some framework because right now it's a flip of a coin.
Yeah.
Right? And flip of a coin cannot be the answer to any legal question.
Right. Yeah.
Right? Because the whole point of the system is predictability.
Yeah.
Right? And having precedent be precedent.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some of the decisions I see now on 101 are literally insane.
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, some of the dissenting Federal Circuit judges agree.
I mean, if some of these things are not inventions, then we should all just go home, right? Yeah. There is no progress anymore to be made for the human race, right? If it's not an invention, it's insane.
My last question is, you know, you've referred to yourself as the Forrest Gump of patent law, but somebody's probably listening to this and is thinking to themselves, wow, that's a really cool career or path. You know, what advice would you give to somebody who wants to be the next Ray Million?
Okay. Yeah, I think I've already gave him the advice. Always keep learning and just be cognizant of how you treat people, right? Like, I genuinely love people. And, you know, Maya Angelou has a famous quote, right? Like, no one will ever remember what you said, but they'll remember how you made them feel. Right? And I think just being a genuine person that's always learning and intellectually curious, the opportunities will come.
Great advice. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for doing it. I really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. I'd also like to thank my firm, Harity & Harity LLP, for their generous support. Clause 8 is produced by Great Feeling Studios and Brick Brewer. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Thanks for listening.